Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why the federal budget deal is not the biggest economic story of the day, how the White House plans to win the future, and what Facebook ought to do with that like button. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the last day of March. Good to have you with us. Tomorrow is the exact halfway point of the federal government's 2011 fiscal year. So it's appropriate to note that today there finally seems to be agreement on a budget for it. Democrats and Republicans in Congress have come to terms on about $33 billion in cuts to be made over the next 6 months. That'll help avoid the first government shutdown in 15 years. But there is an item on the congressional agenda that Wall Street's a whole lot more worried about. The debt ceiling, the legal limit for how much the Treasury Department's allowed to borrow. At the moment, $14.3 trillion. Yes, a tidy sum, but Treasury is already right up against it, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Ever since the financial crisis, Wall Street and Washington have been bickering like an old married couple. And like most married couples, they sort of share a bank account from the U.S. Treasury. Treasury bonds are the safest investment they can hold. They're almost like cash. But if the Treasury can't borrow anymore, those bonds will be worthless and the U.S. government would default.
I think all the markets would react adversely.
That's Ward McCarthy, the chief economist at Jefferies.
It would cause probably massive selling of U.S. Treasuries, and because of loss of confidence in the U.S. government, it would probably also cause the dollar to fall and for at least the U.S. stock market to fall and probably others as well.
Guy Labat is a fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott. He says Congress has to raise the debt ceiling. The alternative would be a worldwide freeze of credit. We saw that once in 2008.
I suspect that a default of the U.S. government would make Lehman Brothers look like a joke.
Labat says he suspects that because the government has never defaulted on its debt. The idea is so unthinkable that no one in the markets is even contemplating it, says Peter Bukvar. He's the equity strategist at Miller Tabak.
I'm sure it will get passed. I'm sure it will get raised, just as it has every single time.
Congress has raised the debt ceiling almost every year since 1995. But as the CEOs of several big financial firms said this week, it's the weight that's making them nervous. Treasury predicts debt D-Day could come as early as April 15th. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Congress may have solved its short-term budget problems, but outside the Washington Beltway, 43 states are in the middle of their own negotiations, almost all of them deep in the hole. Here in California, the deficit could be as much as $26 billion. Talks have broken down, and community colleges are warning that those cuts may force them to turn away 400,000 students. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins takes a look at what that could mean for the state and for the country.
California's community college system is gigantic. It has nearly 3 million students. And back when Gene Ross took classes, it also had the best price, free.
It really is part of the California birthright to have those stepping stones available to you to get a leg up in the world.
Today, Ross is the executive director of the California Budget Project. She says it's not just the students who got a leg up.
California's system of community colleges helped fuel the most dynamic industries in the country. The biotech industry, the high-tech industries, our entertainment industries.
Many students enroll for technical training. Others go on to four-year schools. David Boehm is with the American Association of Community Colleges.
Cuts of the magnitude that we're talking about are, you know, they are going to just result in just an outright loss of access for many individuals.
Boehm says community colleges are facing cuts in Illinois, Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and the list goes on. Those cuts could send students to high-cost schools and force them to take on more debt.
In other words, to say is there aren't other, you know, good options for some students.
California is also expected to raise tuition at its schools. But even with those increases, the state's community colleges are still a bargain compared to the rest of the country. That is, if you can get in. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy is in Japan today. He's the first foreign leader to visit since the earthquake and tsunami 3 weeks ago. Also there is the chief executive of the French nuclear company Areva. She's brought with her a team of engineers to consult on the crisis at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. She's also going to try to shore up some business while she's at it. From the European desk, Stephen Beard reports.
Areva is advising the Japanese on how to remove contaminated water from the plant. It's also donated 10,000 anti-radiation suits and other equipment. But Areva is not an aid agency. It's the world's biggest nuclear company. Its fundamental purpose is commercial, says Alex Barnett of the Jefferies Investment Bank.
They want to sell reactors globally. So for them, limiting the damage here is absolutely crucial. It's absolutely crucial for them that the situation is sort of remedied as fast as possible.
Areva, largely owned by the French government, sells some $16 billion worth of nuclear reactors, fuel and expertise annually. The Fukushima crisis has already costed a lot. Nuclear consultant Michael Schneider says reactor sales to Italy, Britain and other countries have been put on hold.
Projects in South Africa have been shelved. Follow-up projects in China seem to be pretty dead at this point. So you can already see within, you know, less than 3 weeks that the impact is phenomenal.
Some say it could be a decade before anyone orders a new reactor. Steve Thomas of Greenwich University says the best the nuclear industry may hope for in the meantime is to sell the services managing and supplying existing plants. He says that might explain the French presence in Japan.
They are trying to bolster their reputation as the country with all the nuclear expertise at the moment.
But, he says, whatever the French achieve in Japan, this is an industry in desperate trouble. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a tale of two markets, one index up, two of them down, but not a whole lot either way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Google is trying to turn search into more of a social as opposed to solitary pursuit. Yesterday, it announced something called Plus One, where you can recommend search results and web pages to your friends, and then in return, you get to see theirs. Sounds a whole lot like Facebook's Like button, the way that actual social network lets people share things that they dig, movies, articles, what have you. It's the latest salvo, apparently, in people broadcasting their tastes. Commentator Rob Walker says it's time to button it up.
A growing number of Facebook users want a dislike button. You know how you're supposed to like things on the site? This lets you do the opposite. Click to express disapproval of a link or picture your friend has posted. In fact, there's a dislike button page on Facebook, and more than 3 million people have liked it. I'm not one of them because I dislike this idea. In fact, I hate it. I certainly think Facebook could be improved, and frankly, I might like it if the site disappeared tomorrow, but one-click disapproval would not help, because this misguided idea completely misunderstands Facebook. Facebook has nothing to do with honesty, genuine self-expression, or reality. It's a place to present, promote, and receive approval for an idealized persona. That's why everybody looks better in their 3-year-old profile picture than they do in real life, and status updates tout professional successes, enviable lifestyle moments, and the latest feats of adorability of toddlers and pets. What they're not about is screwing up at work, gaining 10 pounds, or how you're sick of your friend's adorable toddler. Facebook is a gated suburb. It's sterile, controlled, happy. It's made of ticky-tacky, and that's the point. Like the burbs, people have flocked to Facebook precisely because it's a cheerier version of reality. Rallying for a dislike button is like complaining that your neighborhood association won't let you sponsor a protest in your front yard or open a nudist commune. You're in the wrong place for that. There's no shortage of ways to express displeasure online, and nobody has to spend their entire web existence among the manicured identity facades of Facebook. You might be annoyed by a friend's link or about politics or the Red Sox, but I can pretty much guarantee that responding with a dislike would not start a meaningful conversation. Besides, Facebook, in its infinite quest to create a 50s sitcom version of internet life, has already given you a very suburban-esque tool to deal with such offenses. Just click on the button that says, Hide.
Rob Walker is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the book, Buying In. We can take your likes and your dislikes if you're really gentle. Send us your comments, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Contact. The Obama administration these days is all about winning the future. That's the tagline behind pretty much every domestic policy proposal they come up with, how to keep America competitive. One key area, as the president talked about in his speech yesterday, is energy. To help get us to those clean power breakthroughs, the administration wants to spend money developing next-generation technologies. But that's running into a very this-generation problem, the federal budget, from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
When members of the administration talk innovation, they start speaking Russian, as in Sputnik, 1957.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket.
Eisenhower's Washington responded by throwing money and bodies at science and tech. It created the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency.
DARPA was created in response to the launch of Sputnik.
Assistant Energy Secretary Arun Majumdar. He says DARPA made breakthroughs like stealth technology and the early internet, long before we were typing OMG, send.
The first network computer started in 1968. It really scaled over the 80s when you launched the internet. It takes that kind of time to scale.
Majumdar runs a new agency that's a cousin of DARPA. ARPA-E is the Advanced Research Project Agency-Energy. And in energy, the space race of today is batteries. At stake is the emerging electric vehicle market, by some projections a $100 billion industry in two decades. Today, plug-ins drive just 50 miles, maybe 70 per charge. The electric holy grail is a battery with 10 times that range.
Everyone is trying to create that battery. No one has it in the world.
The U.S. lags the battery market, but aspires for a space race kind of boost. Enter battery firm PolyPlus in Berkeley, California, backed by ARPA-E money. PhD chemist and founder Stephen Visco tinkers with those crazy potions from 10th grade lab. Remember lithium in water?
It's a lot of excitement. It fizzes up and you get a little hydrogen cloud, and then there's typically a spark, and that ignites the hydrogen, and you get a little bit of a Hindenburg there.
If you could lose the Hindenburg part, lithium and water actually make for an ultralight marathon battery. And Visco says he's done it.
We make something almost looks like an ice cream sandwich, and it has two of these rather remarkable ceramic membranes surrounding it.
And to prove it, he dunks his lithium gizmo in the company fish tank. And plop, plop, no fizz. Just a light bulb on the gadget flickering on, indicating electricity. For his next trick, Visco hopes to take his invention to market with the help of $5 million from ARPA-E. So why does a company like this need public money? Proponents say private investment tends to diss these shoot-the-moon ventures. They take too long. The PolyPlus battery could take a decade to hit the vehicle market. And yes, time is money. Silicon Valley venture capitalist Tom Baruch.
For the kinds of programs we back, generally 5 years is about it. And many venture capitalists are shying away from investing in energy because of the time and the capital requirements.
That's the void ARPA-E tries to fill, and to keep up with Asian competitors and their state funding. And yet, this is the government with a track record. Josh Lerner at Harvard Business School recalls Synthetic Fuels, a Carter-era program that dumped $20 billion into a failed program to turn coal into natural gas.
The highway of government programs here is littered with carcasses of programs that were ill-conceived or ill-implemented, where large amounts of money have gone to firms, but very little innovation has come out of it.
So will ARPA-E be the next boondoggle or the next DARPA and seed tomorrow's generation of Boeings and Googles? We'll only know if the program gets funded long-term, and proponents want $1 billion a year from Congress. That is a risky venture. In Berkeley, California, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, in this age of social media, public relations is a whole new thing.
We'll send them articles and say, okay, what do you think about this? And we'll get their input, and we can help edit their thoughts into a tweet.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave up 30 points today, a quarter of 1%, ended at 12,319. Also down was the S&P 500. It shed 2 points, nearly two-tenths of 1%, closed at 1325. But on the brighter side, the NASDAQ picked up 4 points, just over a tenth percent, settled at 2781. Oil traders pushed up the price of West Texas Intermediate to more than $106 a barrel, 106.72. For those of you who like some accuracy, that's the highest level since September of 2008 for crude. Higher gas prices could keep motorists at home, and that put the brakes on oil stocks today. Shares of ConocoPhillips tanked more than 1%. Chevron and ExxonMobil each dribbled down about a half percent today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues unemployment data for the month of March. The Commerce Department reports on construction spending for February. And it's the program that brought us the biggest wedding of the 20th century. Luke and Laura were married on General Hospital. The show debuted on April 1st, 1963. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So we were talking earlier about the federal budget, and from Wall Street's perspective anyway, the more important point, the federal debt limit. Thing is, pushing up the debt ceiling, as we do regularly, inevitably leads to more debt. And that sort of thing makes a guy like John Malden crazy. He's the president of Millennium Wave Investments in Dallas, Texas, and he's got a new book out. It's called Endgame, The End of the Debt Supercycle and How It Changes Everything. John, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So I think most people know what the business cycle is, right? That expansion and contraction of the economy that occurs at reasonably regular intervals. You are talking, though, about a super cycle and specifically a debt super cycle. So I think we have to define some terms here.
What happens is people start borrowing money at the end of some great cataclysmic event. In our case, it was World War II. When we were borrowing that money, we got a lot of bang for the buck. You'd borrow a dollar and you'd get sometimes $6 worth of GDP growth. By the end of the cycle, 60 years later, we were getting about 40 or 50 cents for every dollar. So we weren't getting really much bang for the buck. We weren't getting enough growth to overcome the growth of the debt.
How does a super cycle end, though, John? I mean, we're not getting as much back for it, but consumers have been borrowing in this economy for a long time.
First, citizens, individuals, businesses come to the end of their ability to borrow, which is what happened with the subprime and all the mortgage debt. And so we've started paying down the debt. The government stepped in, but the rule is that governments cannot grow their debt faster than nominal GDP, that's just the growth of the economy, for longer than a few years without running into trouble.
Let me stop you right there for a second, John, because you point out and you make this point repeatedly in your book that people only change when they have to change. That is to say, the American taxpayer, the American consumer, and American politicians are only going to change after things have come to a head.
Well, that's been the tendency of humanity and governments over the last 200 years. The quote that we start the book out is from Jean-Paul Monnet. He's an Italian with a French name. But he says, you know, people only accept change in the face of necessity and only see necessity in the face of a crisis. If we as the United States could understand, guys, we're going to have a crisis that will force us to change. And that crisis will mean that we pay a lot more interest on our debt. So that interest eats up a lot more of our budget so that we have less money left over to spend on education and welfare and Medicare and defense and all those things.
Well, then lay it out for me. What are the choices left to avoid a crisis?
We've got to do two things that the polls say that people want to have and don't want to have. They want to have a lot of Medicare and they don't want to see their taxes raised. Those don't work together. And for me as a Republican, just saying the word tax and increase in the same sentence, you know, I get hives. But the only reason that I would use the word tax and increase in the same sentence is that I am worried about the future of the republic.
Those are serious words, John. The idea of the debt problem that we have being an issue for the survival of the republic. But here's what I didn't find
in this book. Quite serious about it.
I believe you are, but here's what I didn't see in the book. Between all the macroeconomic examples and the charts, I didn't see a discussion of the realities of the political system and how we're talking about our debt. We are still in this country having a debate over $60 billion worth of the teeniest, tiniest corner of the margins of the federal budget. And yet we are not in Washington having a discussion anyplace over the substantive issues.
Over the $1.2 trillion we actually need to cut.
So how do we get there?
It's going to take more movement than anybody presently today thinks. And one thing that I don't believe the politicians are doing right now very well is they're not explaining the problem. Because if they explained the problem, then they have to start talking about, well, what's my solution?
Yeah.
And they don't want to publicize their solution yet because if it was a real solution, it's going to make the voters upset that would vote for them. It's kind of a catch-22 for politicians, I guess.
John Malden. His most recent book is called Endgame. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All the changes to the media business the past five or so years, newspapers and magazines dying off, bloggers and tweeters driving the news cycle as easily as the networks, that hasn't just changed media. PR gurus, spin doctors, and communications professionals behind a lot of the stories you hear have had to adapt, too, because managing the message, it just isn't what it used to be, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
The problem with doing a story about PR is most of your sources are PR professionals. It's their job to put a positive spin on things. And I'm going to get to those people. But first, meet David Brotherton. He has his own communications agency in Seattle.
You can call me a recovering PR hack. Just kidding. Don't do that.
For years, he worked at PR agencies, sending out press releases and calling journalists to pitch his clients' products. He says back then, PR people controlled the message, or at least tried to be gatekeepers. But in an era of digital communication, the gates have collapsed.
Consumers are skilled and increasingly empowered to seek out the information that they want to find. And the role of the PR middleman is decreasingly useful.
Brotherton says companies can get their message out themselves quickly and cheaply using social media from blogs to Facebook. But PR practitioner Norman Birnbach says a lot of them wouldn't know where to begin.
We hear often a question from prospective clients, isn't social media just a fad?
After Birnbach clears that up, he explains their customers are on Facebook and YouTube and they need to be there too. Once clients sign up, he keeps up the guidance.
We'll send them articles and say, okay, what do you think about this? And we'll get their input and we can help edit their thoughts into a tweet. And in some cases, we schedule it for them.
Birnbach says most of his new business this year is from clients looking for help with social media. At global PR firm Edelman, social media work helped drive profits up 18% last year. Russell Dubner heads the firm's New York office. He says the entire PR business has had to change because the public gets its information from so many sources.
So if you just go in with a single thread approach to it, you're not going to get action from the consumer, the customer, whoever is, you know, the target you're trying to engage. So we've had to create more of a surround sound in how we go and engage the public.
PR is now coming at us from 360 degrees on multiple platforms. That's a lot of platforms for companies to keep an eye on. Chrysler recently fired the agency that tweeted on its behalf after an employee wrote a profanity-laced tweet dissing Detroit drivers. Russell Dubner says, sure, the job's a lot harder these days, but in a good way.
You don't just go around saying something is terrific. You need to prove it and show it in an imaginative way.
And that's not just the case for products. It goes for ideas, too. All those blogs and websites need a steady stream of new content to stay in business, and they can't produce it all themselves. David Brotherton says rather than pitching a dwindling band of reporters to get his clients' views across, he writes a lot of op-eds on their behalf and places them at sites like the Huffington Post.
There is a greater willingness in the online media, anyway, to accept commentary because there's less need for them to be arbiters of the truthfulness of that piece.
The site labels it opinion and fills its need for content. And he's still doing his job of getting his client heard. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes to you in the form of a riddle. What do the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States and Goldman Sachs have in common? Answer? They really don't like being told they have to give up information. This morning, after the Supreme Court ruled that it had to, the Fed released the names of the banks that got emergency loans back at the depths of the financial crisis. 900 computer files that have to be opened and read individually. No index, no search capability. Pretty much the same way Goldman Sachs did its data dump on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, if you remember that. Borrowers from the Fed, by the way, ranged from big to not so big. Mighty Goldman Sachs five times, all the way to the Bank of Yazoo City, Mississippi. And that's it. We're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow ditched 30 points, about 0.25%. Also down was the S&P 500, off 2 points, nearly 0.2%. The NASDAQ picked up 4 points, just over 0.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, you know, healthcare is where the jobs are at, but the competition for them, oh, that's pretty steep.
Anytime you have more people entering a field, then they just simply up their standards of what they want.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.